I wanted to talk about. Well, I don't know. I mean, so many things. Very quickly, let me see. We talked about going to the U.S. and coming back. I guess. Well, not really coming back. Going down. And then the writing. '93, I graduated fall from Queens, and I had an interesting experience. I don't mind saying this. I don't mind saying this at all because many people have had the same kind of experience. I defend it, and I think it was late September 1993, and I graduated Complicated in late October 1993. And because I'd already published a few things, people knew on the East Coast that I was finished, that I was ready to go looking for a job, my first job, excuse me, and all that. And so I like to say to people ever since, the phone did not ring. The phone did not ring. Nobody was calling to say, and I applied to places and wasn't getting any answers back. I don't think I even got any form letters back. It was just like a big void. I told people what I was working on, what I was interested in. There was no response. And of course, I had to live. I had to survive. So I continued to do the same thing I'd been doing before, which is work on a screenplay. Two screenplays, which is what put me through graduate school. CBC. A lot of people say, did you get a Shirk grant? No, I got two CBC grants to write movies for them. I'd finished. The phone wasn't ringing. Nobody was offering me anything. And nobody seemed to be interested in Canada and what I had to offer. But I had been invited to Duke University to give a talk at the Canadian Studies Center in April 1992. And I'd gone down there, and I didn't know it at the time, but there were people there who were very interested in recruiting me back in April 92, and I had no idea. I just knew that Ted Davison, who taught Canadian literature, liked my poetry, and thought it'd be interesting to have me come and give a talk and a reading at the Canadian Studies Center. But Kathy Davidson, who was his wife, and he decided that it'd be nice to try to drum up further interest in my work. So they put together a little luncheon at their house then. This was in rural North Carolina, not far from Durham, Hillsboro, North Carolina. And they invited a good swath of the English department to come to their little luncheon. And so who was there? Eve Sedgwick-Kozofsky, Barbara Herrnstein-Smith, Jonathan Goldberg, Michael Moon, of course, Kathy, Ted, and probably a couple other people who I can't remember now. But anyway, they were there, and I was basically given a kind of congenial interview without knowing it at this little luncheon. But in any event, I didn't think too much more about it. I went left and came back. But then in the fall of 93, Ted and Kathy got in touch with me to tell me, or actually, no, it was fall of 92. They got in touch with me and asked me to apply for a position at Duke. And I did. And I wasn't hired. I made the short list, but I wasn't hired. And they said, look, we really think you need to finish your doctorate, and then maybe you'll have another opportunity. So, of course, I finished. And I sent them a letter saying, I'm finished. And if you're still interested, I'd like to have another go at it. So they spoke to the president at Duke, who was interested in me, the provost, blah, blah, blah. African-American studies, Canadian studies, Department of English. And there was a lot of interest. So I was invited to come and give a job talk. And I did. And it was based on my dissertation. And I was hired by a majority vote, a strong majority vote. And particularly what I really liked very much is the fact that Stanley Fish was very, very supportive of my work. So then I, of course, had to make plans to move to the U.S. In summer '94, and I did so. And, the other thing I have to say here, I'm not criticizing anybody, but I will say, as soon as word got out that I'd been hired at Duke, the phone rang. At my home, and an offer was sent to me from one institution by courier immediately. But of course, by then it was too late, and I was ready to go. I was feeling like, okay, where were folks
when I needed you?
When I was looking for what I was going to be doing to earn a living, or looking for some other support. So anyway, So I moved down, and they were very, very good to me. But of course, as soon as I got down there, I became not really homesick, but more like kind of nationalistic for Canada and all that. I guess all my nationalism was still there. And so that, of course, encouraged me to continue to come back and do research and hang out and go to conferences and all the rest of it. And I always had it in mind that I would come back to Canada. And of course, eventually that's what worked out. But at the same time, all this was going on from 94 to 99. I also started working on my play, Beatrice Chansey, which also became an opera. And in fact, it started off as an opera. And in 92, the composer, James Rolfe, wrote to me when I was still in Kingston and asked me to consider writing a libretto for him. And so I said, yes, having not done it before, having given it much thought. I said, okay, sure. So, excuse me, I started working on that. And basically, that was Beatrice Chansey was basically one of my, if I can say this, one of my American works. Because I was writing about slavery. I was starting to talk a little bit more about racism in ways I never really talked about in my work before. And so that was important to me. And I had a lot of support, once again, from Ted Davidson especially, various people at Duke who were interested in reading my manuscript. And of course, the folks in Toronto who wanted to put on the opera. So anyway, one thing led to another. And the opera got staged finally. It had its debut performance in Toronto in June 98, and it had its first stage production as a play in July 98, I think it was. And July 97, excuse me, yeah, July 97. And what else can I say about that? I got a Bellagio fellowship to go to Italy because of it, so that was nice. And went and finished writing it, or finished writing most of it there. And so, yeah, that was the American experience. I've run past all kinds of stuff there. What can I say? I mean, I think it took a good 3 years before I started to feel that I was really there. And that was mainly because I kept coming back to Canada to do research and so on. I kept coming back here, and I would feel emotional about it. You know, I'd go to Quebec City, I'd go to Halifax, come to Toronto, and I think, oh, you know, what have I given up going to the U.S.? And that was, in some ways, that was positive. In some ways, that was positive, because it really made me think about Canada more fully than I had before. On the other hand, I wasn't fair to the U.S. I didn't give Americans enough due. We were ready to make that commitment to stay there, and then... I heard that U of T was interested in taking a look at my file. So one thing led to another, and I got an offer that I thought was pretty good. And because I'd always thought about coming back to Canada, we decided to come back. But I have to say, I'm going on and on and on about this, but I was really, at the time, just before I came back, I would really say 98, later 98 into 99, I was really starting to feel quite comfortable being quasi-American. I mean, it's a weird thing. I remember when I first went down there, I was at a dinner party at Ted Davidson's with John Thompson, who is a Canadianist at the Canadian Studies Center at Duke from Manitoba originally. This was the first year I was there, and John, we were talking about U.S. imperialism, of course, right? And John said something about the U.S., but he started using the words we. And he was talking about Americans. He's saying, we do this or we do that. I forget what the exact sentence was, but I remember I immediately... Sid, this was like January 95 or so. I said, what are you talking about, this we? You're Canadian. And he was sort of silent. He didn't say anything about that. But then, I have to say, by the time I was ready to leave, I was thinking we, as in being part of this great American experiment, with all of its problems and contradictions. And I hope I'll always maintain a little bit of that appreciation I finally started to develop for the U.S. I hope I will. As much as I think I know and like this country and love this country, I think that being in the U.S. was a really good experience in a lot of ways. I mean, being anywhere other than your native country is very, very good, I think. But what am I trying to say here? It's like, first of all, I mean, I don't want to fall into a whole bunch of cliches here, which is easy to do when you talk about national differences. But one of the things I really started to appreciate about the U.S. was that people are more honest. They're not as hypocritical. I'm going to say that. They're not as hypocritical as Canadians. Canadians are hypocritical about race and racism and cultural difference. We are big hypocrites about it because we pretend that everything's fine. There's just a few bad police and a few bad other folks out there who do the racism, and everybody else is perfectly fine. And the real racist problem is the U.S. I mean, it's funny. When I was down there and coming back, I would pick up the paper, and almost every day, whether it's the Globe or the Toronto Star or any paper in this country, there was always at least one article that was extremely critical of the U.S., either in an editorial fashion or in terms of the news story. Because, of course, papers get all kinds of news stories sent to them over the wires. They choose certain ones and ignore others. So the fact is, though, that Canadian media was always running stories that were somewhat critical of American behavior and American ways. And I understood that because we had to justify to ourselves why we're not part of the U.S., why we decided to take a different route with the American Revolution or from the American Revolution. And we remind ourselves every day that we took the better route. I understand that, and maybe it was the better route. But at the same time, it presents a very skewed idea of the United States. I mean, I don't think that Canadians, unless they've traveled and lived there quite a bit, have a good understanding of the United States or why the U.S. works the way it does. One of the things that I found that I had to come to terms with as somebody who's on the left, and this is really weird, being on the left and living in the U.S. is a weird situation to be in. I mean, in Canada, it's okay because the country is not a superpower and the left isn't in power anyway at a national level. And so you're used to thinking in a kind of oppositional way and in a way that is about trying to influence people who are in power, trying maybe to get power at a provincial level, and so on and so forth. Okay, fine. But in the U.S., there is only one effective leftist or left-leaning party. And even to say that is a big contradiction in terms. It's the Democratic Party. And then what's even worse is that the Democratic Party, I didn't understand this until I went down there. I used to think that there was no left in the U.S. Everybody was either liberal or conservative, like Republican or Democratic, and that was that. I didn't understand. Or they were members of some real minor party, like Socialists of America or something, which have no power and very little membership. And I didn't understand it until I went down there that, in fact, Democratic Party, this is bizarre, but the Democratic Party actually, at least its rhetoric, is not unlike New Democratic Party rhetoric. It's not. It's amazing. It's like, we're all about public housing. We're all about ending racism. We're all about rights for everybody. We're all about progress and the environment, everything, right? But then, that's the party's official policy, voted on national, conventions, the party platform, the policy, blah, blah, blah. And that's fascinating because, of course, that party's in power, at least in the White House. The guy who's president, the leader of the party, supposedly, has a platform that has everything in it that's not unlike New Democratic Party stuff, right? But then there's a huge problem with that at the same time. Even though he's got this leftist constituency, or left-leaning, I should say, constituency out there within the Democratic Party, he's got a huge problem in that sense. At least, I shouldn't say he does, because Clinton, of course, wouldn't feel he had a problem. But for me, looking at it, there's, of course, one huge contradiction with all this. He's also, the president, or senators or congressmen and women, are also representing a superpower. A superpower with global responsibilities that lead to sometimes some very unsavory actions on the part of the state. And for that matter, for the sake of domestic politics, some very unsavory domestic legislation. And yet they've got all this really progressive rhetoric. It's wild. But then you have to think about it. Since this is the reality there, it means that you have to work within, if you're on the left and you want to get anywhere, I mean, you can try to build a third party, and the Greens are doing better now, especially with Nader as a presidential candidate than they have been previously. But still, by and large, your left-leaning politics is bound up within the Democratic Party. But at the same time, a party that has lots of ties to big business, big corporations, and big corporate interests. And it makes for a very difficult balance. I'm not making any sense here. But what I was starting to try to understand while I was living there was that like it or not, this is probably the way you're going to have to do things. If you wanted to get any kind of progressive legislation passed or laws enacted, you had to work through this, or probably we're going to end up working through this party. Quite bizarre. At the same time, this party has a leader who's in charge of this incredible capitalist imperialist colossus. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, in pure Marxist terms, you can't. On the other hand, what's the alternative? Yes, you can work forever with a small third party of some sort and do some local things, but or even try to build some kind of national movement. But even with that, it's extremely difficult. I'm going on too long about this, but what I'm trying to say is that what I liked about their experience, what I saw of their experience, was the fact that people were more honest about where they stand. And the fact they're more willing to fight with you about it. I mean, openly, and not hide their feeling, but just tell you up front. You know, like, this is how I feel. And I don't want to support stereotypes, but in Canada, I mean, if you're really interested in fighting racism, sexism, homophobia, you've got a problem because everybody's on side. The Canadian Alliance is against all of that. The Conservatives are against all of that. The Liberals are against all. NDP is against all of that. So, okay, everything should be fine. This should be paradise then, right? Except, of course, it's not. Except, of course, you still have to fight all these battles, but against people keep saying, we're really on your side. You know, that's the... Nothing to fight. Although, in the U.S., of course, they're up front. No, we don't like you. And that's healthy. That's healthy because you know who your friends are and you know who doesn't like you. You know, and in terms of organizing, it makes things a lot easier. You may not win in the end, but it makes it a lot easier. You know you're not shadow boxing. You know you're not beating up on friends or for that matter, going along with false friends. You know who's on your side and who isn't. And that kind of clarity is really dynamic. It really sharpens you. So I know as a result of having lived down there, I started writing poems that were far more confrontational than the poems I was writing when I was still living in Canada.
The big sin in Canada is to be confrontational.
It's rude.
It's rude. It's impolite. It's unpardonable.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
It might hurt somebody's feelings.
You can't say that. But, yeah, I like that. That's one thing I miss, too. Having come back here, and I keep trying to hope that I'm maintaining some sense of, but we learned a lesson. I shouldn't say this either in terms of confessions. I shouldn't say this, but no, I'm not going to say it. Well, okay, I'm not going to, no, I can't, because see, I learned my lesson. I'm not going to say anything about this, but I will generally say that I had an occasion where I was invited to say what I thought about a certain situation. Before figures of authority, and I took that promise or that invitation at its letter and was critical, although not unthinkingly critical, of a certain institution, and the result was people were very unhappy with me. Again, not to belabor this point or to be beating a dead horse, things were just a little more open in the U.S. But that, of course, had a price tag, too. Things were a little bit more violent in the U.S.
Right.
Because of that. And the way I'd like to sum it up for people is to say, if they like you, they love you. If they hate you, they'll kill you. They'll shoot you. That's basically it. You know. So, of course, I prefer to have a little bit more of the gray than just strictly black and white. One reason why I decided to come back here, because I didn't want to end up in a situation where I was going to feel in fear of my life. Not because of anything I would say, but just because when you get people right to bear arms, they will. And they'll use them and feel they have a right to.
There are many different ways of killing people, though, right?
It's true. But, I mean, that percolates, you know, that percolates throughout the entire society. That revolutionary ethos is there. I mean, even though Americans themselves may not always recognize its existence, I feel as an outsider living there, looking at the society, that, yeah, they really do believe in it. Even if they have very diametrically opposed, polarized viewpoints of what the letter of the Constitution means, the spirit of it, they really do believe in it. They really do believe that, you know, of course, right to bear arms is a problematic one, but yes, they do believe in that, but they, of course, also believe more or less in freedom of speech and so on and so forth. Maybe a little bit more than we do in Canada. But at the same time, it's true that it is, simply because it is somewhat more dynamic and liberal, small and liberal as a society, it tends to be a little bit more lawless, where people tend to feel they can take the law into their own hands a bit more, or do whatever they want a little more. And that's both positive and, of course, very negative in terms of the resultant violence that that attitude tends to encourage.
Okay.
We can do volume 2.
Oh yeah, the new project. Which I hope will be a kind of an extension of Beatrice Chansey and other work, the poems that I've been writing over the last few years, and that is a novel, which is the reason why we were in Fredericton last week, because 6 years ago my mother mentioned to me that my two first cousins once removed, George and Rufus Hamilton, who were born in the same place I was born, Windsor, Nova Scotia, and George Hamilton and I were named for the same man, his grandfather, my great-grandfather, George Johnson, also of Windsor Plains. And anyway, to make a long story short, my mother told me that these two fellows, two brothers, were executed in Fredericton for murder in 1949. They robbed a taxi driver, and in order to effect the robbery, hit him over the head with a hammer, too hard, to make a long story short, once or twice, but it was enough, and he died either immediately or shortly thereafter. This happened on a Friday night, January 1949, and they were arrested on a Tuesday afternoon. So they made no attempt to get away. They did hide evidence, including the body, which they put in the trunk of the gentleman's taxi cab, and then they hid the taxi. They didn't really hide it. They just drove it down a not well used road. Let me put it that way. Oh, but used well enough that someone stumbled across the remains Monday. Just a couple days after the murder itself, which I believe was accidental. But all that to one side. I was fascinated by this because I had a great aunt, Portia White, who was a great control till the 1940s and is now on one of the Canadian Millennium stamps. And I knew all about her when I was a kid growing up. She's in the same series as Glenn Gould and the others as a music pioneer in the country. And she was my great aunt. So very proud of her and what she accomplished. And also, again, as I mentioned her before, because she was an influence, I think, for Walter Borden. But anyway, I always knew about her. And she was always a role model for me. But, of course, my mom and her side of my family were always embarrassed by what happened to these two guys. So for most of my life, I'd never heard of them until 6 years ago when I was 34. And then I started doing research, which the greatest amount was done up till now, was done in 96. And I went to the National Archives and dug up the files for these guys, the trial records, transcripts, and read them. 1,400 pages of documentation of the trials. They had separate trials and what happened to them. And up to the hangings and all that. It was a double hanging, by the way, in Fredericton. 1,000 people tried to see, crowded into the city. I just found that out last week. But anyway, I decided I needed to write something about them, and I decided it would be a novel, my first novel. But the other thing about this case that I want to do more work in is exactly how the death penalty cases, or capital cases in Canada, had the death penalty, helped to illuminate racial and ethnic relations in this country. It's fascinating. I don't want to sound too morbid. But, okay, in the U.S., as we know, the death penalty has always been at least somewhat racist in its application. If you were white, you might get life imprisonment or even get a lesser sentence and not necessarily be executed. If you were black, you're more likely just to go straight to execution, no matter whether we're talking 1999 or 2000 or 1800 or 1899, what have you. In Canada, as usual, it was a little bit more complicated and also a little bit more equal opportunity. The way it worked here, I'm no expert in this, but from I looked at the files that they kept from 1867 to 1962 when the last hangings took place, right here in Toronto, actually, in Canada. Anybody who, okay, if you were of British extraction, you had a fighting chance that you might get exonerated, or rather, that you might not get hanged if you were British in origin. Except, of course, if you were Irish or Scottish. That might count against you, actually, in terms of the death penalty. But if you were French Canadian, Native Canadian, Southern European, Eastern European in extraction Canadian, or black but from the West Indies or the U.S., you were more likely to be hanged here. And I think, I mean, one of the projects I'm trying to figure out exactly what I should do about this, but one of the things I want to go, okay, I want to do the thing about my cousins, but looking at their case got me looking at a couple of others as well, and I think they really do illuminate, really, in ways that other historical documents don't, exactly how communities interacted or interrelated. I mean, for instance, this was really fascinating. I came across one case from 1885, Nova Scotia. A black man was convicted of first-degree murder because he had stabbed a white man who later died, of course, and he was convicted and sentenced to hang, but his sentence must have been commuted because 9 years later his wife was writing to him in Kingston Penitentiary. So it got commuted. And I think the reason why is because of the context of the case, which I'm taking a long way to say this, you're getting at this from a long way around, but what was really fascinating about this case, when I looked at the records, the actual records of the trial, was that the stabbing took place in the context of a riot that no one has ever documented or talked about. They had a little riot in Bridgetown, Nova Scotia in 1885, May 1885, on a Saturday night. And the reason why, it involved roughly about 20 white men and about 5 or 6 black men. So it was a small riot, but it was a riot.
It was a riot. You get that many people,
yep,
yes.
Yep. What had happened was, from the testimony given in court, it appears that one of the black men had been dating a white woman in Bridgetown. The other... So some of these white men didn't like the idea, to put it mildly, and so they began hurling stones and insults at a small group of black men standing at the road, the entranceway to the road leading into the black community just outside Bridgetown, NS, but now inside Bridgetown, NS. Anyway, these guys decided then to rush the black men. So this group of 20 white guys is coming down, this group of 5 or 6 black men, and in the ensuing melee, one of the black men stabs one of the white men. So it was self-defense. Now, the judge at the trial tried to keep all this out. I mean, he was trying to keep this information suppressed from his charge to the jury and his attitude towards the defense attorney. But the defense attorney was very good in bringing out what was going on in Bridgetown at the time this stabbing took place. And so I think that's why the sentence got commuted eventually to life in prison. Not that that's much better than being hanged, but still. I think that's why it happened, because there was this context of self-defense. But beyond that, there's the whole question of this riot that was going on that no historian has talked about, because it doesn't exist in any records except in this court case. And so I think that a lot of these hangings have to be looked at again. As to exactly what they meant in terms of race relations and ethnic relations at the time they took place. There are other cases, too, that I think we need to look at. And, I'm a scholar of Canadian literature, and specifically black Canadian writing. People haven't talked about these cases or written about them, unlike the U.S., where these cases have been turned into literature from time to time or even examined by legal scholars. But I think that's yet another thing. I also feel a kind of obligation to recover these bodies, to find out what was it that led to, or what social factors led to these people being condemned to the gallows, and what that says about the society as a whole at the time. So I don't know where this is going to go. I have no idea. All I know is that I'm learning a lot about hangings.
Useful.